Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Dan Novak tells us about efforts to offer medical and mental health treatment to migrants arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border. Brian Lynn presents this week's science report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Dan Novak.
Many migrants are arriving at the U.S.-Mexican border in need of medical and mental health treatment. Doctors, social workers, shelter directors, clergy, and law enforcement officials say growing numbers of migrants have experienced or witnessed violence. Dr. Brian Elmore volunteers at a health center in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. The city is on the U.S.-Mexico border. Elmore has treated about 100 migrants for viruses affecting the lungs and some for emergencies. But he said trauma worries him the most. Most of our patients have symptoms of PTSD. I want to initiate a screening for every patient, said Elmore, who is an emergency doctor at Clinica Hope. PTSD stands for post-traumatic stress disorder. It is a condition of extreme tension caused by a shocking or severe event in the past. But there are few resources for this kind of care. Shelters have been flooded by new arrivals and migrants who have been in Ciudad Juarez for months. Only the most severe cases are treated. Like a pregnant 13-year-old who fled gang rapes and so needs help with child care and middle school, said Zuri Reyes Borrero. Borrero works in Arizona with the Center for Victims of Torture. He said he visited such a girl when she gave birth. We get people at their most vulnerable, he said. In the past 6 months, Reyes Borrero and a co-worker have worked with about 100 migrants in Catholic Community Services, Casa Alitas. It is a shelter in Tucson, Arizona. In December, Casa Alitas was receiving about 700 people daily, released by U.S. officials. They came from countries including Congo and Mexico. Each visit can take hours, as the caseworkers try to build trust with migrants, Reyes Borrero said. Most migrants are traumatized by what they left behind or what they saw on their trip, said Leonce Biamana. He is director of U.S. Clinical Services for the Center for Victims of Torture. He said the migrants need first aid mental health as well as long-term care that is even harder to get once they leave the shelters. Left untreated, trauma can get worse to the point where it requires psychiatric care instead of treatment and self-help, said Dylan Corbett. He is the Hope Border Institute's director, the group that operates Clinica Hope. Reports say there has been an increase in pregnant women and girls in the border area. Some are victims of attacks. Some are younger than 15. Volunteers and activists have used limited legal, medical, and other resources to help these victims. The situation has left hundreds of other victims of political violence and organized crime without help. In many cases, forensic tests at border medical centers that aim to record mental and physical abuse are very important to migrants' asylum cases. Biamana said often no other evidence is available for courts to make asylum decisions. Asylum is given to those who cannot return to their countries for fear of harm or violence. That can include violence against women. But it takes years for asylum cases to be decided in U.S. immigration court. Syracuse University's Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, an information center, said more than 1.5 million people are waiting for their cases to be heard. I'm Dan Novak.
...2022 was a busy year for the United States National Aeronautic and Space Administration, and 2023 promises more space progress. Today, we look forward to some of NASA's planned missions. One of NASA's major missions last year resulted in a successful uncrewed test flight that sent the Orion spacecraft into orbit around the Moon. The mission is part of the space agency's Artemis program, which aims to land American astronauts on the Moon by the mid-2020s. In preparation of that goal, NASA has contracted with private companies to build landers for the Moon. Their design permits them to carry equipment and instruments for studying conditions on the lunar surface. Several landers are expected to arrive on the Moon this year. One, developed by NASA partner Intuitive Machines, is set to launch in early to mid-2023. The IM-1 mission will land at an area called Schroeder's Valley on the near side of the Moon. Another, built by NASA partner Astrobotic, is to launch sometime before April. The space agency said that spacecraft, called the Peregrine Lunar Lander, is expected to land near Lacus Mortis, an area near the equator of the Moon. The lander's instruments will collect data on and examine many parts of the Moon's atmosphere and surface. In addition, they will study things like how radio signals behave on the Moon and will test landing technologies and communication systems. The European Space Agency, ESA, plans to launch a spacecraft to explore Jupiter, the largest planet in our solar system. Jupiter is a giant gas planet with an atmosphere made up mostly of hydrogen and helium. ESA officials have said they plan to launch the Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer spacecraft, called JUICE, sometime in April. The mission will make detailed observations of Jupiter as well as its three large moons, Ganymede, Callisto, and Europa. ESA says it hopes the in-depth observations will help scientists learn more about Jupiter's complex environment as they use the planet as a model for other gas giants across the universe. NASA plans to launch its Psyche spacecraft in early October. It is expected to travel 3.5 years to an asteroid. The metal asteroid is orbiting the Sun between Mars and Jupiter. NASA wants to study it. Scientists believe it may have separated in violent clashes during the creation of the solar system. The other will be a return mission of NASA's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft. It spent more than 2 years observing an asteroid named Bennu. In October 2020, the spacecraft successfully collected sample material from the asteroid. OSIRIS-REx is now on a trip back to Earth with an expected arrival in September of 2023. Scientists say they hope the sample can help them better understand how planets formed, as well as how life might have developed on Earth. Boeing's Starliner spacecraft is set to attempt its first crewed test mission to the International Space Station, ISS, in April. The test is the last step in the process before NASA approves the spacecraft to carry out regular missions to the ISS. Private American company SpaceX, another NASA partner, has been transporting astronauts and materials to the ISS since 2020. Starliner completed its first uncrewed test flight to the ISS in May, but Boeing experienced several technical difficulties with the spacecraft during the mission and has worked with NASA to fix the problems as it prepares for the planned crewed flight. NASA also plans to fly two experimental aircraft in 2023. The first mission is called Quest. It involves a NASA research plane called X-59, a supersonic aircraft. Supersonic is a term for an object that travels faster than the speed of sound. The goal of Quest is to provide data that could change rules that ban supersonic flight over land. NASA says X-59 was developed with technology that reduces the loudness of a sonic boom to very low levels heard on the ground. NASA's other experimental plane with plans to fly in 2023 is called X-57. The aircraft runs on electric power. It was built to demonstrate that all electric technology could make flying cleaner, quieter, and more sustainable. I'm Brian Lynn.
Now, Brian Lynn joins me to talk more about this week's science report. Hi, Brian. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome, Ashley. Thank you for having me.
So, last week's science report looked back at some of the biggest space missions of 2022. In our conversation then, we talked about a couple of launches to look out for in the coming year. In this week's report, you describe even more planned missions. Since space stories are always popular among our listeners, maybe you can give us a preview of some other missions set for 2023.
Sure, Ashley. We've heard a lot from NASA in recent years about its plans to return American astronauts to the moon sometime in the mid-2020s. In preparation for that, the space agency completed an uncrewed test mission late last year of a spacecraft that successfully orbited the moon. And next year, NASA plans to send at least two landers to the surface of the moon.
What will be the purpose of the landers?
So the landers, which were built by private companies partnering with NASA, will carry equipment and instruments for studying a range of conditions on the lunar surface. They will also test some different landing technologies and communications systems to be included in future missions to the moon.
Okay, and what other missions are currently planned?
Another big one will be led by the European Space Agency in partnership with NASA. That mission is called JUICE, which is also the name of a spacecraft that will be making the most detailed observations yet of the planet Jupiter. The spacecraft will also observe three of Jupiter's large moons.
I know the report says the JUICE spacecraft is set to launch sometime in April. Do we know how long the trip will take to reach our solar system's largest planet?
Yes, well, don't expect any of those mission results anytime soon. The trip to Jupiter is expected to take 8 years. Then the spacecraft will spend about 3 years observing.
Got it. Well, thanks again, Brian, for joining me on today's show.
Sure. Thank you, Ashley.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On July 4th, 1863, a huge Confederate army surrendered at Vicksburg, Mississippi. Union forces had surrounded the city for 47 days. Food was gone. The situation was hopeless. The Confederate commander gave up. The terms of surrender were simple. The Confederate soldiers promised not to fight anymore. In return for this promise, they were released on parole and sent home to their families. Never had Union forces won such a victory. 30,000 Confederate soldiers were now out of the war. 60,000 guns and 170 cannon were now in Union hands. The Mississippi River was now under Union control. Larry West and Morris Joyce continue our story of the American Civil War.
The victory at Vicksburg went to General Ulysses Grant. He was named commander of all Union armies in the West. Then he was sent to Chattanooga, Tennessee. The Union army there had just been defeated in a battle along a little river called the Chickamauga. Now the Union soldiers were resting and reorganizing in Chattanooga. The Confederate line stretched halfway around the city. The Confederates had artillery on Lookout Mountain. They controlled every road into the city, except a rough one through the mountains. They had blocked the Tennessee River, above and below the city. And they had cut the railroad. The Confederate general said he would let hunger force the Union army to surrender.
Grant arrived in Chattanooga late in October. The city was full of hungry Union soldiers. They had been without supplies for almost a month. Grant wasted no time. He quickly sent troops to fight the Confederate force blocking the Tennessee River. He sent others to fight the Confederates blocking the road to the nearest Union supply center. Within 1 week, supply wagons were rolling into Chattanooga. Within a few weeks, the defeated Union army was ready to fight again.
General Grant sent his men against the middle and ends of the Confederate line at the same time. There were few Confederate soldiers at Lookout Mountain. That end of the line fell easily. The center of the line was along a low hill called Missionary Ridge. It held for a while. Then Union soldiers, acting without orders, forced their way to the top of the hill. The Confederate line broke. Southern soldiers threw down their guns and ran for their lives. The Confederate army withdrew south into the state of Georgia. Tennessee was completely in Union hands. The way was now open for the armies of the North to march into the heart of the Confederacy.
It was clear that the South could not win the war. Too many Confederate soldiers had fallen in battle. None were left to take their place. Supplies were very low. There was not enough food to eat, no shoes to wear, and little left to fight with. No one held any hope of getting supplies from outside the Confederacy. The South was circled by Union troops and warships. All seemed lost. Yet Confederate soldiers refused to stop fighting. They would not surrender. The war would not end until the Confederate armies were defeated by military force.
There was no question that the North had the military strength. Supplies were no problem. Factories were producing more than ever before. Manpower was no problem. Men continued to join the Union Army. Fewer than before, but still enough to make it a powerful force. The problem with the Union Army was its generals. Some were too careful. Some were unwilling to fight. Some did not know how to fight. The only general who seemed able to win victories was Ulysses Grant. That is why President Abraham Lincoln named Grant commander of all Union armies. Lincoln depended on him to end the Civil War.
Grant went east in March 1864, 5 months after the battle at Chattanooga. He decided to make his headquarters in the field with the Army of the Potomac. He said he would not command from an office in Washington, but he went to the city to explain his plans to President Lincoln. Grant noted that, in the past, the separate Union armies had moved and fought independently. He said they were like a poorly trained team of horses. No two of them ever pulled at the same time in the same direction. Under his command, Grant said, the Union armies would pull together. They would hit the Confederates with so much strength in so many places that the rebels could not stop them. Grant said all the armies would attack at the same time.
Grant spent the month of April preparing for the big campaign. The main target, once again, was the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. The Army of the Potomac had 120,000 men. It would move against Richmond from the north. General Ben Butler had 50,000 men. He would move against Richmond from the east. General Franz Sigel would bring thousands more through the Shenandoah Valley to the northwest. These forces were three times the size of Robert E. Lee's army near Richmond. In the west, William Sherman had three armies with more than 100,000 men. His opponent, Joe Johnston, had just 60,000.
General Grant kept details of the campaign as secret as possible. Reporters asked President Lincoln when Grant would move. The president answered, "Ask General Grant." "General Grant will not tell us," said the reporters. Said Lincoln, "He will not tell me either." The final Union campaign of the Civil War began on May 3, 1864. After 2 days of marching, the Army of the Potomac reached the Wilderness. It was a thickly wooded area west of Fredericksburg, Virginia. That was where the Union Army had lost a battle to the Confederates 1 year before. That was where the two armies would fight again.
The battle quickly became a blind struggle. The woods were thick. The smoke was heavy. The soldiers could not see each other until they were very close. Shells set the trees on fire. The wounded could not escape the flames. Their screams filled the air. After 2 days, General Grant decided that the Wilderness was not the place to fight Robert E. Lee. He wanted to get around the end of Lee's army. He wanted to fight in the open, where he could use his artillery. So he began to march his men toward a place called Spotsylvania Courthouse.
Lee moved his men as fast as Grant. When the Union Army got to Spotsylvania, the Confederates were waiting behind walls of earth and stone. For several more days, the two armies fought. At times, they were so close they had no time to load and fire their guns. So they used their guns to hit each other. The Confederate line bent, but it never broke. Once again, Lee had stopped the Union Army. Grant refused to accept defeat. He said he would fight to the finish, if it took all summer. Once again, he ordered his men to march around the end of Lee's line. Lee quickly pulled his men back to a place called Cold Harbor, not far from Richmond. There they waited.
As he had done in the Wilderness and at Spotsylvania, Grant ordered his men to attack hard. It was a slaughter. In less than an hour, 7,000 Union soldiers fell dead or wounded. Grant finally stopped the attack. The Union soldiers returned to their lines. They left behind hundreds of wounded men. For 4 days, the wounded lay on the battlefield crying for help, for water. Men who tried to rescue them were shot down. Finally, Grant and Lee agreed on a ceasefire to take care of the wounded and bury the dead. It was too late for most of the wounded. They had died.
The battle at Cold Harbor ended 1 month of fighting for the Army of the Potomac. The campaign had brought it almost to the edge of Richmond, the Confederate capital. But Grant had paid a terrible price. More than 50,000 dead and wounded. Confederate losses were much lighter, about 20,000. General Grant was beginning to learn an important lesson of the war. The methods of defense had improved much more than the methods of attack.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm...